Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Sagan, and I'm definitely ready to get into the research you've sent our way this week.
And I'm Sam Fleming. Today, we're really digging into live science for the week of October 25th, 25. And wow, it covers like everything from our bodies right up to, you know, the whole cosmos.
Yeah, it's a big one. Our goal here is to give you that comprehensive shortcut, connect the dots between, say, what you eat and its global impact, then jump to quantum computers, and even wrestle with bringing back Neanderthals.
Seriously, wide-ranging stuff. So let's dive right in.
Okay, let's start on Earth with something that really hits home: our food. There's this finding about the environmental cost of meat in U.S. cities.
Yes, and this is quite sobering. It really quantifies the carbon footprint, specifically for meat eaten by Americans living in cities.
And the headline number is just staggering. We're talking 363 million tons of CO2 equivalent every single year, just from meat consumed in cities.
363 million tons. And just so you get the scale of that, it's actually more than the total annual carbon emissions for the entire United Kingdom. Theirs is around 336 million tons.
Wow. So just the meat eaten in U.S. cities outpaces a whole industrialized nation's output.
Exactly. It really shifts the conversation, doesn't it? From just, you know, personal diet choices to a massive systemic climate issue. They actually coined a term for it: the carbon hoofprint.
The carbon hoofprint. I like that. But what really jumped out at me was the variation they found within the U.S. It wasn't uniform at all.
No, not even close. People in different cities eat roughly the same amount of meat per person, but the carbon hoofprint could vary by more than three times.
Three times. So what drives that difference? They mentioned Richmond, Missouri was highest, and Houghton, Michigan was lowest.
Right. And that massive difference, that's the clue. It's not just how much you eat, but where it comes from and how it was produced. The researchers looked at the supply chains for thousands of cities.
Ah, so the logistics.
Precisely. It comes down to the specific farming practices. You know, the type of feed, how much fertilizer was used for that feed, which releases nitrous oxide, a really potent greenhouse gas, things like that.
So it makes a huge difference if your steak came from cattle finished on a feedlot using really intensive methods versus maybe lower intensity grazing somewhere else, even if the end product looks the same on your plate.
Exactly right. And breaking down which meat causes the most impact, well, it's overwhelmingly beef.
I think I saw the figure 73%.
73% on average of that whole urban hoofprint comes from beef production. And even within beef, the emissions intensity, how much carbon per pound of beef, varied by a factor of 4.3 between cities.
4.3 times. That's huge. Again, down to the specific farm practices, transport distances, feed sources.
All of it. The whole chain. But here's the part that actually feels, well, a bit empowering. The research also looked at solutions. And crucially, they found you don't need everyone to completely give up meat to make a massive dent.
Okay, so what did they find? What combination of changes could really move the needle?
They modeled three key things happening together. First, cutting edible food waste in half. That's huge for methane emissions.
Yeah.
Second, swapping a good chunk of that high-impact beef for lower-impact options like chicken or pork.
Right.
And third, just adding one meatless day per week across the city's population. If a city did all three of those things,
what was the reduction?
They could slash their city's total carbon hoofprint by 51%.
51%. Just from those three things, that actually sounds achievable. It makes it seem less like an insurmountable problem.
It really does. It suggests that policies focusing on, say, reducing beef consumption and tackling food waste,
yeah,
rather than pushing for universal vegetarianism, could be a really practical and effective path forward. A key takeaway for city planners, definitely.
It absolutely reframes it. More about smart substitutions and improving the supply chain, less about demanding perfection from everyone. Okay, sticking with big forces on Earth, let's pivot to the weather. We've got Tropical Storm Melissa brewing in the Caribbean, and the big danger here seems to be its speed, or lack thereof.
Yeah, near stationary is the term they're using. It's moving slower than a person walks, like maybe 1 mile per hour. And it's expected to stay that slow for a bit.
And that's the real threat, right? When a storm just stalls out like that.
Absolutely. Combine that incredibly slow movement with the fact that it's intensifying, rapidly fueled by these near-record warm waters in the Caribbean, and you have a recipe for disaster.
Because it's not just passing over an area, it's parking there and just dumping rain continuously.
Exactly. And the forecast is really alarming. We're talking potential for catastrophic, life-threatening flash floods, landslides, especially in vulnerable spots.
Which areas are most at risk?
Southern Haiti, Southern Dominican Republic, and Eastern Jamaica. These are areas that often struggle with infrastructure challenges, and deforestation can make the landslide risk much, much worse.
And the rainfall totals?
They're expecting 8 to 14 inches, possibly even more in localized spots. Just relentless rain over a relatively short period.
That really brings back awful memories of Hurricane Matthew back in 2016. Didn't that one also stall out and cause terrible devastation?
It did. It stalled, intensified, turned north as a major hurricane. The parallels are concerning. And this slowing trend might be part of a bigger picture.
You mean linked to climate change?
There's research suggesting that, yes, tentatively. Globally, tropical storms seem to be slowing down. One study found about a 10% slowdown between 1949 and 2016.
And the thinking is that global warming affects the steering currents in the atmosphere.
That's the hypothesis. Changes in atmospheric circulation patterns, weaker steering winds, lets these storms linger longer. Think Hurricane Harvey over Texas in 2017. It wasn't just strong. It was the lingering that caused the catastrophic flooding.
The difference between a storm moving at, say, 10 mile per hour versus 1 mile per hour is just massive in terms of rainfall accumulation in one spot.
Huge difference. It turns a heavy rain event into a potential flooding catastrophe.
Okay, from the atmosphere, let's go deep inside the Earth. There's some interesting work on predicting eruptions at Mount Etna.
Yeah, this is pretty neat geophysics. They found a way to potentially forecast Etna's activity by looking closely at the earthquakes happening underneath it. Specifically, something called the B value.
The B value. Okay, what is that measuring? How does it relate to magma?
So the B value is basically the ratio of small earthquakes to large earthquakes in a specific area over time.
Okay.
When the B value is high, it means there are lots and lots of small quakes compared to big ones. This usually indicates the rock is heavily fractured, cracked up. Stress is being released constantly in little bursts.
Which suggests?
It suggests magma is actively moving upwards, pushing through the crust, breaking the rock as it goes. So like the sound of constant cracking before a bigger break.
And a low B value means fewer small quakes, more potential for bigger ones.
Right. A lower B value suggests the rock is more solid, less fractured. It takes more stress to build up before it finally breaks in a larger earthquake. So tracking changes in this D value seems to follow the ascent of magma from deep storage zones, maybe as deep as 19 miles towards the surface.
And they've seen this pattern correlate well with Etna's actual eruptions over the past couple of decades.
Apparently so. It gives them a way to potentially track magma migration in near real time, which is, you know, a key precursor to an eruption.
Fascinating. From volcanic fire, let's go to a different kind of fire. The Eternal Flame Falls in New York. This sounds amazing. A waterfall with a fire burning behind it.
Yeah, it's at Chestnut Ridge Park. There's a grotto behind the falls, and inside, a flame flickers, sometimes up to 8 inches high. It's protected from the wind and the water spray.
And what's fueling it? It just keeps burning.
Natural gas.
Yeah.
Highly flammable stuff, mostly methane, some hydrogen sulfide seeping out through cracks in the rock.
And where's the gas come from? Is it ancient?
Incredibly ancient. It originates from decomposing organic matter trapped in a layer of rock called the Hanover Shale, which formed about 419 million years ago.
419 million years.
Wow. Over geologic time, heat and pressure cooked that organic matter, turned it into gas, and now it's slowly escaping to the surface, finding this one spot where it ignites and keeps burning.
Oh.
It's like ancient life breathing fire.
That's incredible. Okay, one more geological wonder. This very unusual diamond found in Botswana.
Oh, yeah. The half pink, half colorless one. It's about 37.4 carats, rough. And it's basically a little geological time capsule.
Now, pink diamonds are super rare, right? And their color isn't from impurities like, say, yellow or blue diamonds.
That's correct. The pink color comes from physical stress, from deformation of the diamond's crystal lattice structure deep within the Earth's mantle. Intense heat and pressure, maybe from continents colliding or mountains forming, literally bend or compress the crystal structure.
And that bending changes how it interacts with light.
Exactly. That internal damage makes the diamond absorb green light, which allows us to perceive it as pink.
So the fact that this diamond is half pink and half colorless tells a story about its formation.
It confirms it formed in at least two distinct stages. The pink half must have formed first and then experienced some major geological stress event that deformed its structure.
Okay.
Then later, perhaps after that stress event ended or the diamond moved, the colorless part grew onto the already formed pink deformed section. But the second phase of growth happened under conditions that didn't cause that same structural damage.
So you can literally see the boundary between two different geological episodes in one crystal?
It's an amazing little record of Earth's deep history. Just incredible.
It really is. What a perfect jumping-off point to leave Earth behind and head out into the cosmos.
First up, we have 3I Atlas. That's the third interstellar object we've detected passing through our solar system. And like the others, there was some immediate speculation.
Alien technology, right? It always comes up.
It always comes up. But thankfully, new telescope images have pretty much put that to rest. It's behaving like a comet.
So what are the images showing?
They show it shooting out a huge jet of gas and dust towards the sun. This is totally normal cometary behavior. As the nucleus gets closer to the sun, it heats unevenly, ice is sublimate, and you get these jets. Standard stuff, really. No alien spacecraft needed.
Okay, so it's a comet from another star system, but the story gets really exciting because of pure luck, right? We have spacecraft nearby.
Exactly. This is the serendipitous part. Two European Space Agency missions, Hera, which is on its way to the Didymos Dimorphos asteroid system, and Europa Clipper, heading for Jupiter's moon Europa, are basically going to fly right through its tail.
Seriously? Through the tail of an interstellar comet?
Yeah, they're positioned to pass downwind through this enormous tail, which is millions of kilometers wide. It's happening relatively soon, late October, early November. A totally unique, unexpected opportunity.
But can they actually study it? Do they have the right instruments?
Well, that's the catch. Hera doesn't really have the instruments needed to analyze the ions or the magnetic structure of the tail. But Europa Clipper does.
Ah, okay. What does Europa Clipper have?
It has a sophisticated plasma instrument and a magnetometer. These are exactly the tools you'd need to measure the composition of the gas and dust, the plasma environment, how the solar wind interacts with it, basically to sample the tail directly.
So if the mission controllers can react quickly and maybe tweak its operations,
they could potentially get the first ever direct sampling of material from an object that originated outside our solar system. It's huge. Analyzing its composition, the isotopes, it could tell us so much about chemistry and formation processes around other stars.
An actual taste of interstellar space. That's incredible. Okay, moving from the interstellar visitor back to our own neighborhood, we had a couple of comets putting on a show recently.
Right, Comet Lemon and Comet Swan. They were at their brightest around October 21st. Lemon was the brighter one, around magnitude 4.
Bright enough for naked eye viewing under good conditions.
Yeah, potentially. Always a nice sight. Swan was fainter, definitely needing binoculars or a telescope, around magnitude 5.9.
And Comet Lemon had some drama. I saw pictures of its tail getting disrupted.
Yes. Astrophotographers captured what's called a disconnection event. Basically, strong gusts of solar wind can literally rip the comet's plasma tail away temporarily. It looks quite dramatic.
And wasn't there also a shot of it with auroras?
Yeah, that was beautiful.
Yeah.
A photographer in Scotland caught Lemon streaking through the sky during an unexpected geomagnetic storm, so you had the comet and the northern lights in the same frame. Just a stunning dynamic view of the solar system in action.
Wow. Okay, let's talk about something a bit stranger, Chiron. It's one of those objects orbiting out between Saturn and Uranus, kind of an asteroid-comet hybrid.
That's right, a centaur. Chiron is about 125 miles wide, and it's known to have rings, which is already unusual for such a small body. It had three known, dense, stable rings.
But now they found something new.
Yes. Observations from 2023 picked up signs of a broader, more diffuse disk of material surrounding the known rings, stretching out hundreds of miles. It looks like an active, evolving system.
So maybe a recent collision kicked up debris, or perhaps icy material erupted from Chiron's surface.
Those are the leading ideas. It suggests the ring system isn't static. It's actively forming or changing right now. And there is another weird finding.
Go on.
They spotted a very faint feature way out almost 870 miles from Chiron, which is well beyond its Roche limit.
Okay, the Roche limit. Remind us what that is.
It's the distance from a celestial body within which a second body, held together only by its own gravity, will disintegrate due to the first body's tidal forces. Or, looking at it another way, it's the zone where material generally can't easily clump together to form a moon because the main body's gravity tears it apart.
So finding stable-ish material outside the Roche limit is strange. It shouldn't really hold together as a ring structure out there.
Exactly. It challenges our understanding of how these ring systems form and persist, especially around smaller bodies. Maybe there's some ongoing energy input keeping the particles spread out, or maybe the system is just really, really young and hasn't settled down yet.
So Chiron is giving us this rare snapshot of ring formation happening in a way we didn't quite expect.
It's a fascinating puzzle. Definitely makes us rethink ring dynamics.
Okay, let's zoom way out now to the center of our own Milky Way galaxy. There's been this long-standing mystery about a gamma ray glow.
Yes, for about a decade, astronomers have detected this excess of high-energy gamma rays coming from the galactic center. A leading theory was that it could be the signal of dark matter particles annihilating each other.
Dark matter annihilation, that would be huge, obviously. But there was a problem with that theory, wasn't there? Something about the shape.
Exactly. The observed glow wasn't spherical. It was kind of flattened, maybe oval-shaped. But our standard models of cosmology, like the cold dark matter model, generally predict that dark matter should form a big spherical halo around a galaxy like ours.
So the shape didn't match the prediction.
Right. And because of that mismatch, many astronomers started favoring an alternative explanation that the glow wasn't dark matter at all, but just the combined light from thousands of undiscovered, very old, rapidly spinning neutron stars called millisecond pulsars.
Okay, so two competing theories. But now, new simulations are shaking things up.
They really are. These incredibly sophisticated simulations called the Hestia Suite model the formation of galaxies like the Milky Way in great detail. And they found something crucial.
Which was?
That the dark matter halo near the center of a galaxy like ours, which has gone through mergers and interactions with other galaxies over billions of years, shouldn't be perfectly spherical. It gets distorted. It should actually be flattened, maybe oval, or even slightly boxy because of those past gravitational encounters.
Wait a minute. So the simulation predicts a flattened dark matter shape?
And the observed gamma ray glow is flattened.
They match.
They match. Suddenly, the dark matter annihilation theory looks much stronger again. It doesn't completely rule out the pulsar theory, but it makes dark matter a very compelling explanation for that mysterious glow.
That's a potentially massive piece of the puzzle falling into place. We still need better telescopes to be absolutely sure, right?
Definitely. Future instruments like the Square Kilometer Array and the Cherenkov Telescope Array should hopefully give us the resolution needed to definitively distinguish between the two possibilities. But this is a big step.
Okay, from our mature galaxy, let's rewind the clock using the James Webb Space Telescope, looking back at the very early universe.
JWST looked at over 250 young galaxies, seen as they were just 800 million to 1.5 billion years after the Big Bang. And what it found basically rewrites the story of early galaxy formation.
How so? Were they different than expected?
Much different. They were far more chaotic, turbulent, and frankly messy than theories predicted.
Messy how? What was causing the chaos?
Gas. Just enormous amounts of cold gas flowing into these young galaxies. This gas fueled incredibly intense bursts of star formation, but it also stirred everything up violently. Instead of settling into nice, orderly rotating disks like we expected, the gas was moving in all sorts of directions at once.
So galaxies like our Milky Way didn't start as elegant spirals. They were more like turbulent whirlpools in their youth.
Pretty much, yeah. They likely only settled down into the ordered structures we see today after they'd used up or blown out a lot of that initial massive gas supply. It paints a much more violent picture of galactic childhood.
Wow. Sticking with cosmic structures, astronomers found something truly enormous connecting dwarf galaxies.
This is mind-bogglingly big. They found a previously unseen bridge of neutral hydrogen gas stretching 185,000 light years between two dwarf galaxies, NGC 4532 and DDO 137.
A bridge of gas that long, that's wider than our entire Milky Way galaxy.
Exactly. And that wasn't all. Trailing behind this pair of galaxies, they found a galactic tail of gas stretching an unbelievable 1.6 million light years.
1.6 million light years. That has to be a record.
It's the longest such tail ever detected.
Yeah.
And the likely cause is something called ram pressure.
Ram pressure, like a wind.
Sort of. These dwarf galaxies are falling into the much larger Virgo galaxy cluster. The cluster is filled with incredibly hot, diffuse gas. As the dwarf galaxies plow through this hot gas at high speed, the intergalactic gas acts like a powerful headwind, stripping gas away from the dwarfs and stretching it out into these immense structures.
And understanding these tails and bridges is important because it shows how gas gets moved around and recycled within galaxy clusters, which affects future star formation.
Precisely. It's cosmic recycling on the grandest scale.
Okay, before we leave space entirely, a couple of things closer to home, or maybe too close. First, this asteroid ray, 2025 SC79.
Yes, a concerning one because it was hiding in the sun's glare. They call these twilight asteroids. This one's pretty big skyscraper sized, about 2,300 feet across.
And finding these is hard because they're close to the sun and the sky, right?
Exactly. They're often only visible during the brief twilight periods, making them very difficult to spot with traditional surveys. And this one has some unusual characteristics.
Like its speed.
Yeah, it has the second fastest orbit known for any asteroid, whipping around the sun in just 128 days. And crucially, its entire orbit is inside the orbit of Venus. It's only the second object we know of that does that.
So it never gets very far from the sun from our perspective. The danger is that if one of these twilight asteroids was on a collision course with Earth,
our warning time could be extremely short, maybe just days, not the years we might get from spotting an asteroid further out. It highlights the need for better detection methods looking towards the sun.
Definitely unsettling. And speaking of things falling from the sky, there was that piece of space debris found in Australia.
Yeah, this was pretty dramatic. A charred piece, about 5 feet wide, was found still smoldering in the Australian outback not long after it re-entered the atmosphere.
Smoldering? Wow. Do they know what it was?
The suspicion is that it was part of a Chinese Geelong 3 rocket, which is known for sometimes having uncontrolled re-entries of its upper stages.
And that's a recurring issue, isn't it? Concerns about large pieces of Chinese rockets coming down unpredictably.
It is. There's ongoing criticism because large stages, often weighing hundreds of pounds and made of tough materials, are sometimes left to tumble back to Earth without any guidance system. The risk of debris hitting populated areas isn't zero, especially for larger pieces like this.
It really drives home the need for better global standards and practices for managing space debris and ensuring controlled re-entries.
Absolutely. It's a tangible reminder of the risks piling up overhead.
Okay, that's a good, if slightly worrying, place of transition back to Earth. And specifically, inward to ourselves, human biology, health, and some really deep ethical questions.
Let's start with something maybe a bit basic, but scientifically interesting. Why is pooping feel good?
Right. It sounds like a joke question, but there's actual physiology behind it, and it's more than just relief.
Totally. The most obvious part is relieving the physical sensation of stretching or distension in the colon and rectum. Nerve endings send signals to your brain saying, okay, this is uncomfortable, time to empty.
But there's that feeling of relaxation, too. Where does that come from?
That's the vagus nerve.
Yeah.
It's a huge nerve, a major part of your parasympathetic nervous system, the rest and digest system. The act of defecation stimulates the vagus nerve.
And stimulating the vagus nerve does what?
It triggers a calming response throughout your body. It lowers your heart rate, drops your blood pressure slightly, shifts you out of a stress state. And fMRI studies have actually shown that this process lights up reward centers in the brain, like the anterior cingulate gyrus. Your brain literally rewards you for doing it.
So it's biologically reinforcing a necessary function. Makes sense. Okay, from momentary feelings to long-term well-being. There was a study linking happiness to longer life, and it found a surprisingly low threshold.
Yeah, this is interesting. They use the Cantrell Life Ladder Scale. You rate your life satisfaction from zero, worst possible, to 10, best possible. They looked at how this related to premature death from chronic diseases like cancer, heart disease, diabetes.
And the key finding.
The threshold where happiness started correlating with a reduced risk of death was only 2.7 out of 10.
2.7, that's really low on the scale. You basically just need to be slightly above worst possible life territory.
Pretty much. You don't need to be ecstatic to see a benefit. And they quantified the effect above that threshold. For every 1% increase in happiness score above 2.7, there was a 0.43% decrease in the risk of premature death.
That's significant. Even small improvements in subjective well-being seem to have a measurable protective effect on health.
It suggests that promoting well-being, even modestly, could be a powerful public health tool. Maybe it helps buffer stress or encourages healthier behaviors.
Okay, let's talk sleep. We're getting much more sophisticated than just good sleeper versus bad sleeper, right? Researchers identified distinct sleep profiles.
Yes, five distinct profiles based on measurable brain activity signatures, not just self-reporting. And these different profiles seem linked to specific cognitive or mental health issues.
Can you give an example?
Sure. They distinguish between, say, poor sleepers, whose brain patterns correlated more strongly with anxiety and mood symptoms, and disturbed sleepers, whose issues seemed more tied to problems with cognitive function and memory consolidation during sleep.
Why is making these finer distinctions important?
Because it could lead to much more personalized treatment. If you can identify someone's specific neural sleep profile, you might be able to predict their risk for certain conditions, like depression or anxiety, earlier. Or it might explain why some treatments like standard cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia don't work for everyone. maybe around 40%, don't respond well, they might have an underlying profile that needs a different approach.
Tailoring therapy to the specific type of sleep disruption makes sense. And finally, the age-old question, why does time seem to speed up as we get older? There's a neurological explanation proposed.
Yeah, linked to something called neural dedifferentiation. Basically, as we age, brain activity tends to become less specialized, less distinct for specific tasks.
How did they test this in relation to time perception?
They had younger and older participants watch an Alfred Hitchcock movie while scanning their brains. They found that older participants' brains shifted between fewer distinct neural states, and each state lasted longer while processing the movie's events. Younger brains, in contrast, were constantly switching between many different shorter states, effectively logging more distinct moments.
So it connects to that idea that our subjective sense of time passing is related to how many new or distinct memories or events we encode. If older brains are processing things in bigger, less differentiated chunks,
then fewer distinct events get logged per unit of actual time, making time feel like it's passing more quickly. It's like your brain isn't taking as many snapshots.
So the potential antidote is to keep giving your brain novel things to process, learning new skills, travel, new experiences.
That's the implication. Keep challenging your brain with novelty to maintain that fine-grained event logging, and maybe time won't feel quite so compressed.
Fascinating stuff. Okay, let's move into medical breakthroughs and some really thorny ethical areas. First, a promising development for vision loss.
Yes, a trial using the Prima implant system for age-related macular degeneration, or AMD. This combined tiny eye implants with special augmented reality glasses.
And the results were good.
Remarkably good for a small, early trial. 80% of the patients who had lost their central vision due to advanced AMD were able to read again using the system.
80%? That's potentially life-changing. How does it work? How does it bypass the damaged part of the eye?
It's really clever. A tiny photovoltaic chip, meaning it's powered by light itself, is implanted surgically under the retina, where the light-sensing photoreceptor cells have been damaged by AMD.
Okay.
Then the patient wears special AR glasses. These glasses project patterns of infrared light onto the implanted chip. The chip converts that infrared light directly into electrical signals.
And those signals stimulate the remaining healthy cells in the retina.
Exactly. They stimulate the downstream nerve cells that are still functional, sending signals along the optic nerve to the brain, which interprets them as vision. It's currently black and white, but it essentially creates a new pathway for visual information.
Incredible engineering. Now, a bit of science history that led to a Nobel Prize bioorthogonal click chemistry.
Right, this is a great story about building on previous work. The original click chemistry, developed by Sharpless and Meldahl, was this super efficient way to snap molecules together using a reaction between an azide and an alkyne. Really useful chemistry.
But there was a catch for using it in living things, right?
Yes. The original reaction needed a copper catalyst to work well. And copper, unfortunately, is pretty toxic to living cells. So you couldn't easily use it to, say, track molecules inside a living organism.
So how did Carolyn Bertozzi and her team get around that? They won the Nobel for this refinement.
They brilliantly modified one of the reacting molecules, the alkyne. They engineered it into a strained ring shape. This ring structure is under tension, making it highly reactive.
It's so reactive.
So reactive that it would just click together with the azide spontaneously without needing the toxic copper catalyst to kickstart it. The inherent strain in the ring provided the energy.
Ah, making the reaction bioorthogonal, meaning it could happen cleanly inside a living system without interfering with normal biochemistry.
Exactly. And that breakthrough opened the door to watching molecules, like sugars called glycans, interacting in real time inside living cells and organisms. It revolutionized fields like chemical biology and drug development.
A perfect example of clever chemical engineering solving a biological problem. Okay, our last medical story is, well, bizarre. A diagnostic case from 1984.
Yeah, this one is definitely unusual. It involved a 3-year-old toddler in Texas.
And the toddler somehow ingested gonorrhea bacteria.
Yes, Neisseria gonorrhea. The mother worked in a lab. She apparently had a petri dish containing chocolate agar, which, despite the name, contains no chocolate, but is a nutrient-rich medium used to grow bacteria like gonorrhea in her car.
Oh, no. And the toddler
apparently found the dish and ate some of the agar medium. 8 days later, the child tested positive for gonorrhea infection.
That's horrifying. Thankfully, treatable, but what a wake-up call.
Absolutely. It's a stark reminder about lab safety, the potential for non-sexual transmission in very unusual circumstances, and the critical importance of securing biohazardous materials, especially around children. just a really weird cautionary tale.
Definitely. Okay, let's brace ourselves now for probably the most ethically complex topic this week, resurrecting Neanderthals.
Right. We've heard claims before, like from George Church at Harvard, suggesting it could happen soon. The current expert consensus seems to be, well, still incredibly difficult technologically, but maybe becoming plausible within, say, 20 years.
Plausible using what kind of tech?
Advanced gene editing like CRISPR, base editing. Basically, trying to reconstruct the Neanderthal genome from ancient DNA fragments, make massive edits to a modern human genome to match it, and then this is the huge hurdle. You'd need a human surrogate mother to carry the pregnancy.
Okay, technically maybe plausible down the line, but the ethics, the sources called it morally abhorrent. Why such strong language?
The ethical objections are profound and numerous. First, there's the absolute impossibility of getting consent from the individual being created. Then there are massive biological risks.
Like immune system issues.
Potentially, yes. And maybe reproductive incompatibilities. Some genetic evidence, like the lack of Neanderthal Y chromosomes in modern humans, hints that male hybrids might have been infertile, suggesting deep biological barriers. The risk of miscarriage or severe developmental problems would likely be incredibly high.
And even if you overcame the biological hurdles, what about the life of that cloned individual?
That's perhaps the biggest moral concern. What kind of existence would a single Neanderthal or even a small group have in the 21st century? Completely isolated, without peers, without the environment or culture they evolved in. Experts raise fears of extreme psychological suffering, of being treated like a curiosity, a spectacle.
Like an exhibit in a zoo, essentially.
That's the fear. A profound violation of dignity. And scientifically, would it even answer the big questions we have about Neanderthals, like their language, their cognition, their culture?
The argument is no, right? Because context is everything.
Exactly. You can't replicate the world of 30,000 years ago. Cloning wouldn't tell us much about their actual lives or capabilities in their own time. Many scientists argue that finding a really well-preserved natural mummy, like Ötzi the Iceman but Neanderthal, would actually yield far more valuable biological information ethically.
And finally, there's a legal gray area.
Yeah. While human reproductive cloning is banned in many places like the US and EU, the specific legality of cloning extinct hominins like Neanderthals isn't clearly defined globally. This raises the nightmare scenario of some private, unregulated entity trying it somewhere with lax oversight, just for notoriety or profit.
A really sobering intersection of technology and ethics. We need to tread very, very carefully there. Okay, let's shift gears for our final section, looking at the ancient past and the future of tech.
We've got some fascinating archaeology, starting with Pompeii and Herculaneum, but focusing not on the destruction, but on the survivors.
Right. This work by Stephen Tuck uses evidence from absence, looking at what's missing to understand who got away.
It's a clever approach. He points to things like empty strong boxes. People took their portable wealth. Missing horses, mules, boats near the coast. People used their transport to flee. It suggests they had warning time, maybe 18, 20 hours, to organize an escape.
And the detail about the household gods, the lairs.
Yeah, these little statues were normally kept in shrines inside houses, but archaeologists rarely find them there. Instead, they often find them on the bodies of victims who died near the city gates or trying to reach boats. It suggests people grab these deeply personal symbols of family and heritage as they fled.
So people from all walks of life managed to escape, rich and poor.
It seems so, a real cross-section. And they tended to resettle fairly close by, often within 25 miles, in towns like Puteoli. There's a great story about one family, the Umbrici.
They made fish sauce, right? Garum?
That's them. Famous garum merchants. After the eruption, they simply moved their business to Puteoli. We know this because their distinctive family name starts appearing on fish sauce amphorae labeled Made in Puteoli instead of Pompeii. Talk about resilience.
Incredible. Okay, jumping across the world to the Maya civilization. New hieroglyphs revealed a powerful queen.
Yes, at the site of Coba in Mexico. Deciphered texts on stelae and something called a foundation rock mention a previously unknown queen named Ixchaquin. She ruled around 573 AD.
And what makes her potentially significant?
Her connections. The inscriptions link her to the very powerful Cayan Kingdom, also known as the Snake Kingdom, which dominated much of the Maya world at the time. For a female ruler, already rare in the Maya world, to have such strong ties to the Kayan dynasty suggests she wielded considerable political influence.
Finding evidence of powerful women leaders really helps flesh out our understanding of Maya society.
Absolutely. It challenges the old view of it being solely dominated by male kings.
Okay, let's move to Europe. Much later, Napoleon's disastrous retreat from Russia in 1812. DNA analysis from a mass grave in Lithuania is changing the story of what killed his soldiers.
We always hear about typhus, starvation, and freezing cold, which were undoubtedly major factors. But this new DNA evidence from the soldiers' remains paints a more nuanced picture of the diseases involved.
So it wasn't just typhus.
Surprisingly, they didn't find strong DNA evidence for the bacteria that causes epidemic typhus. Instead, the two main infectious diseases they identified were paratyphoid fever, caused by Salmonella enterica, and louse-borne relapsing fever, caused by Borrelia recurrentis.
Okay, paratyphoid is spread by contaminated food or water, and relapsing fever, spread by lice.
Exactly. It suggests terrible sanitation during the retreat. Contaminated water sources were likely common. And the louse-borne relapsing fever implies massive infestations among the troops. This disease causes recurring cycles of high fever, chills, and weakness.
So the soldiers were likely weakened by cycles of relapsing fever, making them more susceptible to the severe intestinal infection of paratyphoid on top of starvation and cold. A truly horrific combination.
It confirms multiple overlapping epidemics were sweeping through the already devastated army.
Shifting back much further in time, to the dinosaurs. Fossils from New Mexico dated very close to the asteroid impact. What do they tell us?
These fossils are dated to within about 340,000 years before the Chicxulub impact. And they show that the last non-avian dinosaurs in that region, including huge sauropods like the 70-foot Alamosaurus, were diverse, abundant, and seemingly thriving.
So this supports the idea that the dinosaurs weren't already dwindling or in decline before the asteroid hit.
Exactly. It strengthens the case for a sudden, catastrophic extinction event caused by the impact, rather than a gradual decline that the asteroid just finished off. They were doing just fine until that very bad day.
Okay. And from dinosaurs to ancient humans, analysis of paleofeces. That's ancient poop, right?
That's right. From a site in Mexico called the Cave of the Dead Children, dated to about 1,300 years ago, they analyzed the preserved human feces to see what kinds of microbes the prehistoric Loma San Gabriel people were dealing with.
And what did they find? Were they healthy?
Not particularly, at least not gut-wise. The analysis revealed high levels of intestinal parasites and pathogens, including blastocystis and Shigella.
Shigella causes dysentery, right?
Yes. The high load of these microbes points towards significant problems with sanitation, likely contaminated water, soil, or food, leading to persistent gut infections. It gives us a very visceral window into the health challenges faced by ancient populations.
Definitely visceral. Okay, one last archaeological item. These mysterious wooden figures from England, the Roos Carr figures, they're 2,600 years old.
Yes, found in a bog, they're carved from yew wood, have these inset quartzite eyes, and intriguingly, they seem to have had removable genitalia.
Removable genitalia, wow. And there's a potential link to Norse mythology, to Odin.
Several potential links. Yew wood itself was strongly associated with Odin in Norse tradition. The quartzite eyes are interesting because they're different sizes, which resonates with the myth of Odin sacrificing one eye for wisdom.
And the removable genitalia part.
That could tie into Odin's identity as a shapeshifter, someone known to take on female forms. The switchable gender aspect suggested by the figures might reflect that aspect of the mythology. It suggests these figures might have been ritual objects connected to Odin-like beliefs, maybe during a time when different cultural ideas were mixing in ancient Britain.
Fascinating connections. Okay, let's jump fully into modern technology and innovation, starting with a big claim from Google in quantum computing.
Yeah, their new Quantum Echoes algorithm. They claim it ran a specific task 13,000 times faster on their quantum processor than the world's most powerful classical supercomputer could simulate it, achieving what they call quantum advantage.
13,000 times faster is impressive, but the sources emphasized something else was key here, the verification. They called it a quantum lie detector.
Right, proving that a quantum computer is actually using quantum mechanics and not just some clever classical trick is crucial. This algorithm is apparently the first to achieve quantum advantage and be verifiable by running checks on another independent quantum computer.
How did they verify it? What was the proof it was non-classical?
It comes down to demonstrating entanglement, Einstein's spooky action at a distance. The computation involved reaching an energy state that is mathematically impossible in classical physics below zero. By showing this non-classical result was achieved and could be cross-verified, they provide strong evidence the machine is leveraging quantum phenomena like entanglement.
So it's not just fast, it's provably quantum fast. That feels like a significant milestone for the field.
It really does. Moving beyond theoretical speedups to verifiable quantum computation on real hardware.
Okay, next, an accidental discovery that could help with the massive energy demands of AI. The rainbow on a chip.
Yeah, this is cool. Researchers stumbled onto a way to make a tiny photonics chip generate multiple colors of laser light simultaneously, what's called a frequency comb, like a rainbow.
And how does a rainbow on a chip help with AI energy use?
Data centers powering AI consume enormous amounts of energy, partly just moving data around. This chip could allow many different data streams, each encoded on a different color of light, to travel down a single optical fiber at the same time. It's called multiplexing.
So massively increasing the data capacity of existing fiber optics.
Exactly, which could dramatically reduce the energy needed for data transmission within and between data centers, potentially easing one of the big bottlenecks for scaling up AI.
Very practical potential. Now, something straight out of science fiction. A squishy robotic eye.
This is amazing bio-inspired robotics. Scientists created a robotic lens, basically an eye, made from a soft hydrogel material with tiny graphene oxide particles embedded in it.
And it can focus. How?
It focuses automatically in response to light, specifically the heat from the light. The light causes the hydrogel membrane to shrink or swell slightly, changing its curvature and thus its focal length. The key is it does this passively. No motors, no external power needed for the focusing mechanism itself.
Wow, and the vision quality is good.
Apparently exceptional. The sources mention it has incredibly high resolution, capable of distinguishing details as small as the tiny gap between a tick's claws, which is about 4 micrometers.
4 micrometers? That's incredible acuity for a soft, self-focusing lens. Huge potential for soft robotics.
Definitely. Imagine soft robots with highly capable, adaptable vision systems that don't need bulky, rigid cameras or complex focusing mechanics.
Okay, and rounding out the tech, we saw another leap in humanoid robotics.
Yes, Unitree Robotics showed off their H2 humanoid robot called Destiny Awakening. It's about 5'11" tall.
And the movement was the impressive part.
Very impressive. Videos showed it performing pirouettes, complex balancing maneuvers, even some surprisingly deft karate-like moves. It highlights just how quickly the control algorithms for fluid dynamic bipedal motion are advancing. Getting robots to move gracefully like humans has always been a huge challenge, and they're making rapid progress.
The combination of quantum speed, AI efficiency, soft sensors, and fluid robotics. It really paints a picture of accelerating change. Okay, let's wrap up with some universal patterns found in nature.
This one is really elegant. Scientists discovered that plants in arid, water-stressed environments all over the world tend to arrange themselves in a very specific pattern called perfect disordered hyperuniformity.
Okay, disordered hyperuniformity. That sounds paradoxical. What does it mean? Random but ordered.
Kind of. If you look at a small area, the plant spacing looks random, disordered. But if you zoom out and look over larger distances, the pattern is actually highly ordered and uniform in a statistical sense. There are no large clumps and no large empty gaps.
So it's a pattern that maximizes space and resource use.
Exactly. This precise mathematical arrangement allows each plant to maximize its access to scarce water while minimizing direct competition with its neighbors. It's an emergent pattern that optimizes survival under stress.
And this pattern isn't just in plants.
No, that's what's amazing. Scientists see the same type of hyperuniform pattern in completely different systems, like the arrangement of cone cells in a bird's retina to maximize light capture, or the structure of atoms in certain types of glass, even in the way pebbles are clustered by wind and gravity on the surface of Mars.
Wow. So it seems to be some kind of fundamental principle of efficient self-organization that pops up across physics, biology, geology.
It really looks that way. A universal balancing act between randomness in order to achieve optimal function.
Speaking of optimized shapes, there's a new theory about how Easter Island's giant Moai statues were moved. Forget massive log rollers, maybe they just walked.
That's the idea. Based on pendulum dynamics, the study suggests that the statue's specific shape with a low center of mass, a forward lean, and a D-shaped base that allows rocking was actually engineered for walking them upright.
How would that work? How many people would it take?
By rocking the statue side to side using ropes, a relatively small team, maybe as few as 15 people, could make it sort of shuffle forward, pivoting on the front corners of its base. It challenges those old assumptions that moving them required deforestation and enormous labor forces.
So the Rapa Nui engineers might have cleverly designed the statues themselves to facilitate transport using simple physics.
It certainly seems plausible and much more efficient than dragging multi-ton statues on sleds for miles.
Very clever.
Mm.
And finally, capturing the incredibly fast action of snake strikes.
Yeah, using high-speed video, researchers were able to see the mechanics of venomous snake strikes in unprecedented detail. The whole process is lightning fast, maybe just a tenth of a second.
And they found different strategies.
Yes, three distinct methods. Vipers tend to strike extremely quickly, sometimes even adjusting their fang position during the strike. But elapid snakes, like cobras or crates, often use a different tactic. They might bite down and hold, sometimes biting repeatedly in the same spot.
Why the repeated bite?
The thinking is it helps prolong the venom flow and ensures the venom gets delivered effectively deep into the prey's tissues. Different snakes, different jobs, different tools.
Amazing precision in capturing that split-second action. And that brings us to the end of this massive deep dive. We've gone from, wow, the ethics of cloning humans to the physics of slow-moving storms, the deep history in diamonds, the chaos of the early universe, and back to the hidden mathematical order in desert plants.
It's really striking, isn't it? That theme of organization emerging from complexity runs through so much of this week's science. Whether it's the flattened dark matter halo finding stability after cosmic collisions, or plants finding that hyper-uniform sweet spot between random and rigid to survive, nature seems to constantly seek out these efficient, resilient structures.
It really does. So here's something to think about as you process all this. If nature, across scales, from atoms to galaxies, consistently finds this hidden order, this disordered hyperuniformity that balances chaos and structure for optimal function, what similar hidden patterns might be subtly shaping our own human systems right now? Our economies, our social networks.
And perhaps more urgently, what are the ways human activity, maybe through pollution, resource depletion, or social disruption, might be acting like scars on those underlying natural patterns, causing them to break down? Could recognizing these fundamental organizing principles actually help us restore resilience and efficiency in our own world?
A deep thought indeed. It suggests there's a fundamental geometry to resilience we could learn from.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us on this extensive exploration.
Keep questioning, keep digging into the sources, and keep exploring the connections.